Ladies and gentlemen, can I welcome you to this Vital Issues seminar that the Parliamentary Library is putting on. I can't imagine a more timely topic than the Australia-US Alliance in the 21st century, two perspectives. I welcome you all here, including the Honourable Malcolm Turnbull, who informed us he'd been on the long march to come here, which might be partially important in some of the speeches that we're reflecting on, given that China's role with the United States is a very important aspect of our considerations in this part of the world too. Geoffrey was mentioning to me before we started the different perspectives that we have on the United States and its situation at the moment, both economically and strategically. We also have the different perspectives of the United States' role in Asia vis-a-vis China, and of course the implications, most importantly, for our country, Australia. This is an event that's taking place on the 60th anniversary of the ANZUS Treaty, and we'll examine the current and future challenges of the ANZUS Alliance in the context of US-Australian relations and the Asia-Pacific. ANZUS was reaffirmed, as you all know, recently at AUSMIN, and it's been our most important military and security alliance since the Second World War. Ever since, if any of you read that great history by Gerhard Weinberger of the Second World War, in a tripartite discussion between President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Churchill, and Prime Minister Curtin, we agreed to leave the 9th Division in the Middle East to support the British, while the United States transferred the 43rd Infantry Division to Australia. I think that's the beginning, as far as I can work out, of exact strategic cooperation between three countries. This lecture, of course, is very timely because we have the upcoming visit of the President of the United States here on the 16th and 17th, and we're all very excited to meet President Obama, who used to transit through this country many times on his way backwards and forwards between Indonesia and Hawaii. I'd like to introduce our two speakers. Of course, Professor White's going to be speaking first. Hugh White is Professor of Strategic Studies and the Head of Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU. He's also a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. His work focuses primarily on Australia's strategic and defence policy, Asia-Pacific security issues, and the global strategic affairs, especially as they influence Australia and the Asia-Pacific. He has served as an intelligence analyst with the Office of National Assessments, a journalist for the Sydney Morning Herald, and as a senior advisor to the staffs of Defence Minister Beazley and Prime Minister Hall. He was a senior official for the Department of Defence, where from 1995 to 2000, he was Deputy Secretary for Strategy and Intelligence, and as the first director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. In the 70s, he studied philosophy at Melbourne and Oxford universities. Our second speaker who will follow him is Professor Geoffrey Garrett, who many of you know as well. He's the founding CEO of the United States Studies Centre, which is based at the University of Sydney, where he's Professor of Political Science. He was previously President of the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles, and before that, the Dean of UCLA's International Institute. Professor Garrett is a frequent commentator, as is Professor White, on all aspects of US politics, economics, and foreign policy in Australian media. I almost feel like it's a competition between these two. He's also in The Australian, been reviewed, Sydney Morning Herald, Sky TV, ABC TV, and radio. Amongst the most influential political scientists in Australia, he is the author of Partisan Politics in the Global Economy and is the editor of Global Diffusion of Markets and Democracy, both published by Cambridge University Press, and has had over 50 articles in the world's leading social science journals. He's had academic appointments at Oxford, Stanford, and Yale, and the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a member of New York's Council of Foreign Relations, as well as Los Angeles' Pacific Council on International Policy. As a dual citizen of Australia and the United States, Professor Garrett was born and raised in Canberra and holds a BA Honours from the Australian National University. So in a sense, we've got two ANU people duking it out. He earned his MA and PhD at Duke University in North Carolina, where he was a Fulbright scholar. So without further ado, and with the bells starting to ring and blowing his man already, I call on Professor Hugh White.
Great, thanks very much, Michael, and thanks everyone for coming. Thank you, Dan and Frank and Joanna from the library for making this happen. And it's, Michael said, a very timely moment in history, sandwiched between the 60th anniversary and the presidential visit to talk about the future of the alliance. The starting point to think about the relationship with the United States is to notice just how good it's been for us. Our 60 years since the alliance was signed have demonstrated just what a remarkable piece of policy it was on behalf of Spender, Percy Spender, whose creation it really was. It's supported Asia's stability and Australia's security in a really remarkable way. And it's done that for a very specific reason. ANZUS has supported Asia's stability and Australia's security because it supported American primacy in the Western Pacific. And as British power waned in the post-war decades, the fact that US primacy moved in to fill that gap and allowed Australia still to manage its relationships with Asia and its role in Asia through the mediation of the dominant role of an Anglo-Saxon maritime power that also happened to be our close ally, that has made all the difference to the way in which Australia is related to Asia and to the kind of country we are. The last 40 years of those 60 years has been, I would say, particularly important and particularly sweet. I think the historians would judge that the last 40 years have been the best years in Australia's history since British primacy in the Western Pacific started to be challenged in the 1880s. And it's a sharp contrast to the much more complex and contested era from the 1880s through until essentially the end of the Vietnam War. Since the end of the Vietnam War, the most important thing about America as an ally of Australia is that America's primacy in the Western Pacific has been uncontested by any Asian power. And this was new, this was unique in the history of American engagement. It's now lasted for 40 years, and that's such a long time, and it's been so complete, and it's been so important that it's very easy to take that for granted, to regard it as hardwired into the way Asia works and hardwired into the way America works and hardwired into Australia's place in the world. But it's very important, I think, that we don't take that for granted, that we recognise how much our alliance with America, our place in Asia, the way in which we conceive our place in the world, has been framed by the fact that we have not had to choose between America and Asia because Asia has also chosen America. Because Asia's great powers in particular have chosen not to contest American primacy. And that's not just meant that we haven't had to choose. We've been able to maintain and indeed develop a very strong relationship with the United States and at the same time do all that we've wanted to and all that we have achieved in Asia over those decades. It's also meant that the cost to Australia of being an ally to the United States has been remarkably low. One of the peculiarities of our relationship with the United States that I don't think Australians reflect on enough is how light the alliance is. We think of ourselves as very close allies with America, and we are. But the burden that places on us is very low compared to America and other allies. Think what it would be to be Japanese or South Korean or an American Cold War ally in Europe during the Cold War, or for that matter even today, with thousands of forces based in your territory. Really deep engagements and commitments to operate together in very clearly defined circumstances, and in some cases, like Japan's, very large host nation support payments and so on. We don't have American forces permanently based in our territory. We don't have deeply committing plans which require us to pre-commit to support the United States in very clearly defined operational circumstances. We don't have our own forces forward based with American ready to go in the event of a crisis. It's a very close-aligned relationship, spiritually one might even say, politically, but in operational terms, It's remarkably light. It does get to have got a very light footprint on us. And of course, the other way in which it's been low cost is we simply haven't had to fight many wars. Since the end of the Vietnam War, we have fought no wars in Asia with the United States. And that's because the United States hasn't had to fight wars, because it has, its presence has been uncontested. But that has meant that it's been a very low-cost commitment to us. So the core question for us, as we stand at the 60th anniversary and ask and look ahead, is will this last? The most obvious point to make at the beginning, and one that's terribly important, is that of course we'd like it to. The best outcome for Australia would be for American uncontested primacy to last indefinitely, and for Australia to maintain indefinitely into the future exactly the kind of relationship we've enjoyed for the last 40 years. So the question is not what we'd like, it's what we're going to get. And what we're going to get is going to depend, of course, fundamentally on the transformation of Asia that's now underway. I won't talk a lot about this because a lot of other people have spoken about it recently, including the Prime Minister. But suffice to say that China's rise in particular, and I'll speak about China, not to say I'm going to ignore India, that I do ignore India and the others, but I'll focus on China because I think it's the big one for these purposes. China's rise is a really fundamental change in the way Asia works and has huge implications for America's role in Asia and for Australia's relationship with the United States. When I talk about China's rise, I'm not talking about American decline. This is not a story about the United States. The United States may or may not recover from its present malaise. I think it probably will. But even if it does, China's rise, if it's sustained, and it's not, that's not certain either, but it's the most likely outcome, I would argue, if it's sustained, China's rise will take China to a position which no country has ever been in before, and that is bigger economically than the United States will. They've been there since about 1880, not a coincidence, when the United States overtook Britain to be the biggest economy in the world. So this is a very new and very different situation. Its implications are hard for us to imagine, because it's not just that we have all grown up, but our parents have all grown up. Even most of us in the room, our grandparents all grew up, and our great-grandparents have all grown up in a world in which the United States has been the richest and therefore the strongest country on Earth, with a unique capacity to shape the international order, and it's used that capacity in ways which have been immensely beneficial to the whole world and especially to Australia. But we now do have, if China keeps growing, as it probably will, a completely new distribution of world power of a sort that nobody now living has dealt with before. And in particular, a change in the distribution of power in Asia for the first time in a very long time, centuries. Not only will a Western power no longer be the richest country in the world, but a Western power and an Anglo-Saxon power for the last 2.5 centuries will no longer be the dominant maritime power in the Western Pacific. That's what's going to shape more than anything else what the next 60 years are going to be like. And what is it going to be like? I'm going to suggest there are four possibilities. That might sound like an oversimplification, but in fact I think it's the certain mathematical clarity to these propositions. As China's power grows, either China will continue to accept US leadership in Asia, and many still hope that will happen, or the US will concede leadership in Asia to China, and many fear that this will happen. Or the US and China will agree to share leadership in Asia. Most of us can hardly imagine this. Or the US and China will compete for leadership. And most, I think, downplay that possibility. In a sense, I think, can't quite imagine it. Most of us focus on option one or two. But we see the choices in front of us is either America continues to dominate Asia, or China does. And I'm just here to say, I think that they are by far and away the least likely of those four outcomes. I don't think that China is going to accept US leadership as its power grows. I suppose it's not absolutely impossible. But I think we'd have to ask what would make China do that. The second possibility, I think it's possible the United States might abandon Asia, might concede leadership to China, but I think that's a very unlikely outcome, though not one we should rule out. I think it's possible that the US and China would agree to share leadership, but very hard for reasons I'll touch on in a minute. I must say, I think the real choice is between that option, sharing power, and competition, escalating strategic competition between the United States and China. And I think whichever one of those, whether the US and China find a way to share power or whether they compete for power in Asia, that is going to produce an Asia which is very different and raises very different questions for Australia than the ones we've faced in the past, and particularly in the last 40 years. Now, I would say at the moment that we are clearly headed down the track towards escalating strategic competition. I think we're now past the point where we speculate on the possibility that strategic competition between the US and China might escalate. I think we're now clearly started down that path. And the foundation of that, I think, can be quite simply put. China's policy, never very clearly expressed, but I think quite clearly manifested in its actual conduct, is to gently assert a leadership role in Asia which is comparable to the role that the United States plays in the Western Hemisphere, kind of Monroe Doctrine role. That's not a harsh Stalinist hegemony, but it's a very clear assertion of primacy in the political and strategic affairs of the region. An American policy, never very clearly stated, but I think equally unambiguous, is to resist that attempt by China and to retain its own version, essentially, of the Monroe position in the Western Pacific. That is to maintain the kind of primacy that it's enjoyed for the last 40 years at least. And I would argue that the policy of the United States is pursuing in order to achieve that. That is to both strengthen its own position in the Western Pacific and to build a coalition of countries that it hopes will work with it to resist China's challenge to its primacy. I think that policy is best described as containment. It's not a word, of course, that advocates the policy use, because containment would be incompatible with the economic interdependence, which is so critical both for the US and China and for the rest of us. But the fact that we don't like the implications of the word doesn't mean it's not still the most accurate description of what the United States is trying to do. And yes, it is incompatible with the economic interdependence, which is at the heart of China's economic miracle and America's prospects for economic revival and everything that we hold dear ourselves in terms of our economic future. But the fact that it's incompatible with independence doesn't mean that that's not the policy, and it doesn't mean that it won't be pursued at quite possibly at large risk to that independence. But if we think the only risks of a policy of containment of China and in a determination by the United States to maintain its primacy as the foundation for the order in the Western Pacific, we think the biggest risk of that is economic, though those risks are very large, then I don't think we're focusing hard enough on what's at stake. Because as strategic competition escalates, there is a real risk of that disrupting political and strategic relations around the West, in the Western Pacific, and I believe a real risk of war. It's hard to talk about the risk of major conflict without sounding alarmist or even a bit unhinged. But it is absolutely central to understanding the present situation in the Western Pacific and Australia's present strategic situation to recognise that as US-China strategic competition escalates, there is a risk, small but very real, of that degenerating into a conflict, a war between the world's two strongest states. And there is a real risk that war could become the worst war in history. It's terribly significant that we should do all we can to minimise that risk. That's what's at stake. Now, how can that be done? I would argue that the only way in which we can construct a peaceful future for Asia is to step back from the strategic competition that's engendered by those two quite incompatible visions between the US and China of their roles in Asia and move towards a vision of shared leadership. I don't predict that will happen, by the way. I think it's a very difficult thing to do. I think the most likely outcome is that we'll get it wrong and that strategic competition will escalate and that risks will grow. And one of the reasons why I don't think it'll happen is that it will be very hard for both to accept. Both the US and China will have to make immense sacrifices. China will have to accept that it can't lead Asia as it hopes. America will have to accept that it can't lead Asia as it has. And for both of them, that's an issue not just of interests, but of identity, of the way they see themselves as countries. But of course, it would be a disaster for both of them if they don't. I don't believe either the US or China, American leaders or Chinese leaders, reflect deeply enough on what terrible strategic adversaries the other is. I think Americans underestimate China. China is the most formidable strategic adversary the United States has ever faced, because it's richer compared to the United States than any other. And America is an immensely formidable country. Nobody wants to underestimate the United States as a strategic player. You could ask the Russians about that. Mm-hmm. So it's a disaster if both of them don't. But it's very important to reflect a bit on what sharing leadership means, because it's easy to mishear that and to think what I just said is conceding leadership in Asia to China. Proposing a shared leadership structure in Asia is precisely not conceding leadership to China. It's precisely to avoid conceding leadership to China by framing China's role within an order in which America continues to play a very strong role, which limits the Chinese power. It's about avoiding Chinese hegemony and at the same time avoiding escalating strategic competition. And the existence of that third option, the possibility that we can imagine a future for Asia which is not simply American primacy or Chinese primacy and not escalating strategic competition, is terribly important. Nobody in Asia wants to be ruled by China. Nobody wants escalating strategic competition. Everybody wants the US to stay engaged in Asia in a way that constrains China but doesn't drive the US and China into a destabilising rivalry. And that just means they're going to have to find a way to share power if that's going to be achievable. Now, of course, there are lots of costs to that, including the cost of dealing with a country, or shall we say, with a political system like China's, that we find in many ways alien and in some ways distasteful. But those who find that distasteful have to weigh the costs of the alternative, that is, the costs of escalating strategic competition. And don't talk to me about values. Peace is a value too. And people who pay attention to the history of the 20th century should recognise that. So, quickly, what does this mean for the alliance? Do we expect or assume that the United States will play the same role in Asia's security, stability and Australia's security as it has for the last 40 years? No. China keeps growing. Whatever the next few decades of answers are going to look like, it's not going to look like that. So what role do we want the United States to play? Do we want to support the United States as it enters into this intensifying strategic competition with China? Or do we want to advocate that the United States and China should share power and build that kind of balance? And if we take the second choice, how do we promote it? How do we convey that message to Washington? And how do we work with others in Asia to convey that message to Washington? And that's a real question, because we've never had that kind of conversation with Washington before. We've had lots of discussions with Washington about how we want to manage the alliance. But we've never asked the question, do we want you to remain the dominant power in Asia? That has been, if you like, the absolute axiom of Australian strategic policy. That's the axiom that China's rise is now putting into question. So we have to develop a new sense of what we want the United States to do, which means a new sense of the way we want the alliance to work and a new sense of the kind of conversations we have to have with Washington. And it is something we can work with others to do. Because if you ask yourself if the argument I've just articulated is correct, is it not also true in Jakarta and Singapore and Hanoi and Tokyo and Seoul and Delhi? None of them wants to be dominated by China. Nobody wants to be subject to escalating strategic competition between the two of them. All of them want the United States to stay engaged, but they want the United States to stay engaged in a way which minimises the risk of escalating strategic competition, and that's not the trajectory America's on at the moment. So what are we doing now? Well, at the moment, Australian policy, and I think it is broadly speaking bipartisan, is to encourage the United States in the policy that I've described as containment. That is, the policy of building a position, strengthening a position to resist China's challenge to its primacy on the assumption that the United States can maintain the dominant role in Asia, as it has had in the past, without leading to escalating strategic competition. I think that is simply based on a fallacy. And I think to move away from that, we need to start looking at the future of the alliance in very different terms. I think we need to recognise that for Australia, the future US role in Asia is going to be fundamental. I can't imagine a secure Australia and a stable Asia without a very strong role in Asia, but it's going to need to be very different from the role that we've known in the past and very different from the role that America envisages for itself at the moment. We therefore must see as the most important issue in the development of our alliance with the United States our capacity to develop that conversation with America. And that has some very practical implications. If you believe what you read in the press, when Barack Obama visits here in a couple of weeks' time, he will progress and perhaps even finalise arrangements for enhanced military cooperation between the United States and Australia, which will directly contribute to the evolution of what I'm calling a containment strategy. They won't say that. They'll say that it's simply a bilateral deal between two close allies, and who could object to that? But context is everything. And in the context of 2011, the sort of arrangements they're talking about is simply a step in an escalating strategic competition with China intended to reinforce American primacy. That would be a mistake unless we think that American primacy is the best option for Australia in the future. And I'm sure it isn't. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Hugh. Could I now ask Professor Jeffrey Garrett to make his presentation, please?
Thanks very much. Thanks very much to all of you for being here, to Michael for chairing, and to the Parliamentary Library for putting on this important event. It's a real pleasure and privilege for me to follow Hugh White at the podium, because I think Hugh has done an enormous service to the Australian debate by articulating the position he articulated today clearly and forcefully in a lot of contexts in the past. Now it's more than a year, really, isn't it, since you started working on your quarterly essay. Let me start with the place where I agree with you 100%. The agreement for me would be that I think he said the last 40 years, but I'm going to call it the last 30 years, have been extraordinarily successful ones for Australia. And I think they've been characterized by two things, essentially. The strength, the bedrock foundation of the alliance with the United States, coupled with Australia's integration into Asia. Where I disagree with you is his view that the world going forward is going to be fundamentally different from the world that we have been living in. I want to be, in this context, a small C conservative and say that the strategy that Australia has essentially pursued, the geopolitical and geoeconomic strategy, the grand strategy of Australia, of engaging Asia and China whilst maintaining the alliance with the United States, is not only what's done served Australia extremely well in recent decades, but it's where Australia is today and should be in the future. And the other place where I'm going to disagree with Hugh or diverge from Hugh a little bit is, he's a strategic thinker, spent a lot of time in the defence community. I'm going to suggest that in the contemporary world, economics matters, and it matters a lot. And that the different economic context in the Asia-Pacific, and in particular regarding US-China relations, fundamentally alters the strategic calculation. So that's where I want to go. I'm going to try to go there by asking and then answering a few fundamental questions. I've been teaching a class this year at the University of Sydney called US in the World. It was on the 9/11 decade, and in the last class, we asked the students what was the defining feature of the 9/11 decade. And the majority of students in my class, 300 students, and not a bad sample, was that American decline is their dominant theme of the last 10 years. There's a declinism industry out there. Hugh said he didn't want to get into the declinism industry, but didn't want to subscribe to it, but I think it's important to start there. If you follow, you know, I could give a long speech about US politics and economics today, but let me just say that I think two things about contemporary US. The first is that Europe's economic problems and political problems are far worse than the United States's. That might be damning with faint praise, but I think it's important to remember that the United States is not only not Greece, it's not Italy either. And so just two statistics that I think we should always keep in mind. The US government today borrows money on international markets at under 2% for 10-year bonds. The Italian bond blew out overnight to 6.3 or 6.4. I'm sure we'd all like to be able to borrow money at less than 2%. The second thing I'd say about the United States is everyone thinks that the US is in the middle of a fiscal crisis of gargantuan proportions. It's absolutely true that the US has big public debt problems, and because of the size of the US economy, there are many, many zeros on the public debt. But American public debt today is lower than French public debt, if you use the right statistic, which is net public debt. So the US does have deep fiscal problems. I think the US's worst problems today are political and social ones. The political chasm in Washington isn't going to go away anytime soon. I expect the next month to be a pretty terrible one as the Super Committee on Debt Reduction has to report back in. Everybody has big incentives to do two things. One, not to concede ground. That is, the Republicans won't want taxes to be raised and the Democrats won't want cuts to the welfare state. What will they do? They'll come up with some accounting gimmicks to ensure that they reduce $1.2 trillion in US debt. How are they going to do that? The smart money says they're going to say, congratulations, we got out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Boy, that's saving us $200 billion a year. Lo and behold, we've just saved $1.2 trillion and above. That's not particularly good. It's not going to change anytime soon. But I think there are two bigger things in the US that matter much more. The first one is that the US economy at the moment is in a standoff between investors who won't invest and consumers who won't consume. The reason the standoff is there is because corporations have figured out that they can make a lot of money offshore and by employing fewer Americans at home, and American consumers are too scared to spend because their houses have lost 30% in value and they're worried about their employment. That's typically a place where government would come in to provide a deal that would reboot the economy. I don't see that happening anytime soon. Everyone now says that'll happen, you know, 2013 is when we should look for. But the fundamentals, the underlying fundamentals of the US economy are no weaker today than they were in 2000 or 1990 when we thought the US was a gangbusters economy. US remains the most innovative economy in the world. Its demographics look far more favorable than any other Western country. It's a magnet for talented people around the world. That hasn't changed. At some point, you would expect that to dominate. But the big question in the US is social at the moment. Has the domestic social compact broken down? And let me use an audio visual aid. In the 1990s, when Bill Clinton was president, inequality in the US went up really dramatically. However, people at the bottom of the income spectrum in the US also did very well. So the 1990s were a very successful decade in the US. Median household income went up about 10% in real terms in the 1990s. Contrast that to the last 10 years. Inequality is still going way up. The problem is that the average Americans are now doing absolutely less well than they used to do. Real incomes are down about 10% in the last decade, and most of that decline is in the last 3 or 4 years. Because the US doesn't have a massive European-style welfare state, the only way you can keep the social compact together is for average people to have good jobs and to be happy with their jobs. That's a big challenge for the US. That's a big aside to say, I think declinism about the US is just way overstated. As Hugh said, the US isn't going away anytime soon. Point two, what's that mean about the world we're going to be living in? I think that Hugh described a world dominated by the US and China, certainly in the Asia Pacific, but I think we can globalize that and say for the next 15 or 20 years, we'll really be living in a world where China and the US by far will be the two most important actors in the world. We're probably already in that world today. How do we characterize it? I characterize it as a G2 world rather than a second Cold War. And I think that really matters. So what would a G2 be? A G2 is a world in which the two major economies have to manage their interactions because they understand that the economic stakes in managing their interactions well are so high that they can't afford to mess it up. A second Cold War kind of world would say fundamentally different visions, rising strategic competition, more or less the world that Hugh was sketching. Why do I think the G2 world is a better characterization of the world we live in than a sort of second Cold War? It's the economy, stupid. If you think back to the first Cold War, what do we know about the Soviet Union? We know that the Soviet Union was literally irrelevant to the world capitalist economy, and that the world capitalist economy was irrelevant to the Soviet Union, with the exception of its translation into military power. Contrast that with China. China, as we all know, is integral to the world economy, and the world economy is integral to China's ongoing development miracle. I think that has really big consequences. The big consequences begin with US-China. So what do we know about US-China? It's the largest, certainly the largest, probably also the most imbalanced economic relationship in the history of the world. You probably know that the Chinese government holds more than $1 trillion in US Treasury bills. You may also know that the US trade deficit with China is a gargantuan $270 billion per year. That's big, that's imbalanced. It creates a lot of frictions, including over currency. I think though the one-liner on that is to say, yes, it's imbalanced, but by God, it's codependent. It's codependent because China lends the United States money so Americans will buy Chinese products. We thought that that would get unwound in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, as China had incentives to consume more, the US had incentives to save more. The interesting thing is that the imbalances actually have gone up in the last 3 years, not down. We could talk about why. Second thing I think it's important to say about US-China economically is that multinational corporations are really the glue today in that relationship. And it's a win-win story. American multinationals know that being in China is the ticket to their ongoing success, either using China as an assembly platform for the world, call that the Apple strategy, or using China as the growth market to continue your prosperity. Let's call that the General Motors strategy. I think you all understand the Apple story. And products are designed in California, parts come from all over the world, they're assembled in southern China and then exported to the world. The GM story you probably don't know as well is that General Motors went into bankruptcy after the financial crisis. Obama lent them a lot of money. GM's now paid it back. Everyone's very happy with that. What they don't tell you is that all that money is being made by General Motors cars being sold in China. The problem is they're not made in the US, they're made in China. They're made in China in a JV with SAIC, the Shanghai Automobile Company. Why is that good for China? China loves having high quality multinational firms operating in China because they can watch up close what those firms do, because China's ambition is to create its own global champion firms, and having tight joint ventures with the best companies in the world is a very smart way to do that. And that's what US-China economic relationship looks like today, at least as much as the trade story. Now let me just say two other statistics that I think always bear repeating about China when it comes to the economy. 60% of what China exports is made from parts that it just imported. So it really is an assembly platform more than a manufacturing titan. And second, 60% of what China exports is the exports of multinational firms operating in China, not Chinese entities. This is an unbelievably dense, tightly knit economic dyad between the US and China. Henry Kissinger, writing in the Washington Post early this year, I think it was before Hu Jintao was going to be in Washington, Kissinger, I won't even try the croaky realist voice, but
go on.
if I was trying to be Kissingerian, which I won't do, I can't try to be Kissingerian, but I can summarize what he said, which is he just said, listen, the scenario that Hugh paints is so cataclysmic the incentives for both sides to ensure that it never happens are monumentally high. Now, Hugh, I think, would probably agree that the incentives for it not to happen are monumentally high. He's just worried that even with those incentives, bad things could happen. I'm on the other side. I'm on the glass half full side there. And part of the reason is that there have been many, many, many opportunities for brush fires between the US and China to spiral out of control in the past several years. What I think we observed beginning, in fact, past several years, past two decades, all the way back to Tiananmen Square, when George H.W. Bush did not, in the Chinese view, overreact to Tiananmen Square, there's been an incredible ability of leaders on both sides under Republican and Democratic administrations in the US to manage down the tensions. And, you know, the latest one of those actually only happened last week. The US Senate passed a bill labeling China a currency manipulator. You know, those are fighting words in China, and the reaction, of course, was swift. But that one hasn't escalated either, because the Chinese know that Barack Obama would never sign that bill into law, and the US knows that China isn't going to change its currency policy based on hectoring from the United States. What happens, I think, often in the US-China relationship is that there's a lot of air let out of the balloon for domestic purposes on both sides. Very often the leaderships are speaking internally when they talk about the other country. And I actually think that's a pretty smart strategy. Let's call it a pressure release strategy. You don't want things to blow up, to inflate to the point where they might pop. So at the end of the day, when I look at US-China, I don't see a replay of US-Soviet Union. I don't think Hugh does either. He might want to debate me on whether what's the difference between US-China today and Britain and Germany in 1910, which I think is a, you know, an interesting debate for those who've thought about the preconditions for World War I. But I have this view that the fundamentally different thing about the world is, yes, China's a rising power, but by God, it's interdependent with the world economy, and the US is its most important economic partner, and I think that changes everything. What's that mean for US strategy? I think we're actually going to witness this month a very interesting thing, which is that Barack Obama is going to try to roll out, I'm not going to predict that he'll be successful, but I think he's going to try to roll it out, a new US strategy in Asia. It's certainly not going to be abandoning Asia. The question is, will it be containment? Containment never uttered, but always modeled in Hugh's view, or something else? What I would say is that Hugh's view of rendering of the containment strategy actually looks pretty accurate historically. I mean, Rich Armitage and others in the Bush administration were closer to overt in their rendering of that. That is, that we must build up all our alliances in Asia. We must bring some new friends to the table and make them as close to strategic partners as we can. You know, the most important thing being the Indian-US civilian nuclear deal in 2005. Yes, there's been a lot of that, and I don't think it's going away. In fact, when Barack Obama was in Asia last year and when Hillary Clinton was in Australia last year, they talked up that stuff. But I would expect this month Obama to talk a hell of a lot more about economics. Certainly, you know, even in Australia, where obviously there's probably going to be a Darwin stop, and the Darwin stop will certainly talk about more recirculating of American troops through Australia. But I think Obama is going to do a big economic push. The economic push is going to be about Asia-Pacific economic integration, but it's really going to be about China. And I'm going to call it the socialization strategy of China. That is, the US will try to build some economic architecture in the Asia-Pacific that China will not want to join originally, because it would require big domestic changes in China to make it eligible for admission. But that over time, the incentives for China to join will build up so much that China will join voluntarily at the end. Okay, that's a grand statement. What's the evidence for that? Probably, you know, didn't get many column inches anywhere, actually. A couple of weeks ago, after free trade had been in suspended animation and a dirty word in the US for a long time, Barack Obama pushed through Congress three free trade deals. Two of them were Latin American ones, which were mostly about geopolitics. The third one was with Korea, a big country, CORUS, the US Korea Free Trade Agreement. I think that was also mostly about geopolitics, about Asian institution building. But what is clear about that is that there was going to be no domestic benefit for Obama to pass these free trade deals. None at all. And in fact, he had to take two big prices to get those deals passed. First, he had to extend adjustment for people adversely affected by trade. Second, he had to let the Senate pass this China as a currency manipulator bill. Big prices for Obama externally on that stuff. No gain domestically. Why did he do it? I think he did it because he was looking forward to the APEC meeting. Bless you, Mel. He was looking forward to the APEC meeting in one of his boyhood homes, Honolulu, in a couple of weeks' time. What has Obama wanted to do at APEC? He wanted to announce this arcane thing, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a stalking horse for a free trade area of the Asia-Pacific. And Australia is currently the second largest participant in the TPP negotiations. What do we know about TPP today? It's a small group of free traders that have a lot of bilateral free trade agreements with each other. Let's tie a big bow around it and call it TPP. It's going to be a high quality free trade area of the Asia Pacific. It matters a lot more if you've got big countries in there. And I think that Obama is hoping that at APEC, Korea will join the TPP party, not the Tea Party, but the TPP party. And we know that the Japanese government is thinking seriously about joining the TPP negotiations too, even though in Japan the price for that would be concessions on cherished Japanese protection of agriculture, you know, about as hard as it gets in Japan. So let's play along with Obama's the Obama fantasy for a second. The Obama fantasy says that there's real momentum towards Asia-Pacific free trade that's US-led, high quality on American principles at APEC. Barack Obama then spends 2 days in Australia, but then he goes to Bali to be the first US president officially in the East Asian Summit. You know, the East Asian Summit is probably a very good thing in general. However, from a US standpoint, it has two problems. There's nothing binding in the East Asia Summit. It's an important talking forum. And second, the US came late to the party, wasn't there at the ground floor. I think Obama would like to go to the East Asian Summit and say, boy, have I got a proposal for you. You've organized the entire Western Pacific in Hughes terms. I'm going to bind two sides of the Pacific. And the way I'm going to do it is through this economic integration that we all like. We're stuck in an economic funk. This is what we've got to do. If Japan joined that party, boy, that would be a big deal. If you're China, how do you respond to that? In the short term, it would be impossible for China to join the TPP or anything like it because of the big domestic issues that are the real irritants in the US-China economic relationship: market access, intellectual property protection, issues like that. It's not currency so much. You know, multinational firms don't care about that. They want the currency to be convertible, the capital account to be open, the level of the exchange rate is less important. So imagine this. Instead of trying to contain China, what the US is trying to do is to build an Asia-Pacific economic integration that's US-led on American principles that China would find it hard to join, but ultimately China would like to join. And if China wanted to join, the price of its admission would be some really important domestic reforms that everyone in the West would like. That strikes me as being a smart strategy. I'm going to call it, as I said, the socialization strategy rather than the containment strategy. The military stuff is going to continue, but if I was predicting, I'll make two bold predictions. Prediction one is that if Barack Obama is re-elected in 2012, he'll become an Asia-Pacific president in his second term because domestic stuff will be basically impossible. Presidents tend to be foreign policy presidents. Second, Obama's first term in office will essentially have been, in foreign policy terms, will essentially have been about undoing George Bush's wars. I undid George Bush's wars because I want to refocus the United States on what's really important, and that's the Asia-Pacific, and I'm not going to do it in a way that replays the Cold War. I'm going to take advantage of the globalization and technological innovation that's happened to make the Asia-Pacific century all about economics and much less about traditional military competition. What does that mean for Australia? Australia is extraordinarily well-placed to benefit from that vision. In fact, it benefits today. Most Australians understand the economic windfall that this country has received from China in the recent past. Two things to say about that. First, I don't think it's going away anytime soon. Even if the iron ore boom goes away, the iron ore and coal boom goes away, the next big boom is natural gas sales into China. The next one after that is uranium sales into China and Asia. And after that, Australian food exports into Asia, you know, in 20 years' time, strike me as being unbelievably important because of Asia's massive population, terrible soil and bad water problems. So Australia's comparative advantage, which has served it so well, isn't going away in my mind. It's going to continue. However, for Australia to realise the maximum advantage from its comparative advantage, it needs foreign investment, because there's just not enough money in this country for to realise all the benefits. Where is that foreign investment coming from today? It's not coming from China. It's coming from the United States. Chinese foreign investment in Australia is a big story and certainly growing very rapidly. But at the end of 2010, accumulated Chinese investment in Australia was about $20 billion. Accumulated American investment in Australia was about $550 billion. No one in Australia was upset when Chevron decided to invest $70 billion in LNG facilities in Western Australia, except for people who were concerned about environmental issues. In fact, the final go-ahead wasn't the FIRB, but the final go-ahead, I think, was Peter Garrett saying that the Gorgon project was okay from an environmental standpoint. American investment, Americans invest in Australia, you know, the cliched one sentence that requires a lot of nuance is still not a bad one sentence. Americans invest in Australia because it's a proxy China play with a lot of safety. So rather than thinking only about US, Australia, China as a geopolitical triangle, I think we need to understand that there is an economic triangle that's alive and well. It has served Australia extremely well. I believe it will continue to serve Australia extremely well because the world we're living in is different from the kind of world that we've lived in before. This is not a second Cold War. I think I'll end it right there. Thank you.
Both Professor Garrett and Professor White have agreed to take questions, or if people want to make short comments, which they seek a response to, rather than just make comments, I'm happy to sort of entertain them. Who'd like to break the ice?
We were our normal boring selves.
Maybe I can start off by asking something sort of from left field about population statistics. Professor Garrett hinted at it in his presentation by talking about the United States economic dynamism and the quality of the immigrants that are going to the United States still. China has the well-known problem of a smaller female population and one-child policy. Over time, does that affect China's vitality and strategic posture? I'd like that to Professor White and to Professor Garrett. Does the projection that the United States will grow to 450 million in the next 30 years, in your view, viable, accurate, possible, and will that mean that while 10 years ago the United States was a quarter of the size of China, in 40 years' time it'll be half the size of China population-wise?
Yeah, look, really good issue. The demographic story is central. I completely agree with Jeff. America's demographics are very, very good. Best in the industrialised world, and China's demographics are pretty lousy. However, I don't think that makes a big difference to the strategic story. It means that China will never, no matter how well it grows economically, will never acquire the kind of position in the world that America has had. That is, China won't rule the world. It'll never be that strong relative to other countries. But it will overtake the United States, lousy demographics notwithstanding, and it will continue to grow after it, all other things being equal, nothing is inevitable, but there's a serious prospect, most probable outcome I would say, is that China will not just overtake the United States economically, but continue to grow for some decades after that, to the point where its economy is 30% larger, if you take the latest Citibank projection, than America's, and that is easily large enough to pose a very decisive challenge to the United States, particularly in Asia. I actually think China's capacity to challenge America globally is much lower and much further away, and probably won't get there until India catches up with them. And I think, well, you know, 30 years from now, we'll have a very interesting India-China story. But I think, lousy though the demographics are, I think it's not going to stop China becoming powerful enough to generate the kind of tensions that I've talked about.
The story on U.S. demographics, just to unpack it a little bit, really has two dimensions. One is that the U.S. is still, despite what you hear, the U.S. is still really quite open to immigration. I think that the U.S., for example, today is more open to immigration than Australia is. In terms of the political center of gravity, Malcolm. As in, there's not a bipartisan consensus in the U.S. On a small America. I don't think that term has ever been uttered. Now, maybe that was just a mistake that somebody uttered a big Australia as a word and had to do something with it. But in addition to the new migration flows, the other thing we just have to remember about the U.S. is that the Latino population is enormous and growing really rapidly. And Latinos' cultural stereotypes hold, even if they're muted. A lot of Latinos in the U.S. are Catholic. They tend to have quite a few children, and they're having quite a few children at the moment. It's already the case in California that more than half of the kids born are Latinos at the moment, and that's going to continue. So I think that, and let me just make one broader statement. The broader statement is that if I was doing two... I think Australians today tend to underestimate the US and overestimate China for understandable reasons. Last few years have been terrible for the US, China is everywhere, Australia has done so well as a result. I would expect that to continue in a short term. I don't know what the short term is, 2 years, 3 years. But in the medium term, I bet there'll be some re-equilibration because the China challenges are medium-term challenges, not short-term ones. In the short term, the capacity of the Chinese government is just extraordinary and it can solve a lot of problems. But the mounting structural challenges China has are enormous. In the US, I think it's the converse. At the moment, the political system is incapable of doing anything. But at some point, the fundamentals in the US look pretty good in relative terms. So I'm not saying, boy, the US will be as strong in 2020 as it was in 2000, when it may well have been the most powerful country in the history of the world. I don't think those days will come back. But I do think there'll be some re-equilibration out there. So I think we'll be living in this G2 world for a while. Hugh mentioned India, and we should never forget India. But we also have to remember two things about India. First, its reforms are 15 years behind China's, more or less to the day. And second, if India is going to be another China, it's not going to look anything like China. You know, just think about, what's China's number one strength? Infrastructure. What's India's number one challenge? Infrastructure. These are fundamentally different countries. A bunch of disconnected comments. I'll stop right there.
Just before we take our first question, do you have a headline figure for the rate of U.S. Natural growth in population?
Natural growth? No, I don't. But that 450 number by mid-century is out there, and I don't think 450 million, and I don't think a lot of people are contradicting it at the moment. But we've gone from 280 to 310 or something like that in the last few years. I mean, the pace of growth in the U.S. is still quite extraordinary.
What's interesting is it's a mixture of natural growth and
immigration. Yeah, yes,
because the U.S., like Australia, has a very high rate of natural growth compared to other developed countries. There's a question there, please, the gentleman.
Yes. By the way, American, I like your rosy picture. I kind of think that this is kind of like a more realistic. But in terms of like,
you can't be rosy and realistic.
I'm an American. All right, so I'm like, in relation to, you guys brought up India, and I was wondering, like, with the rise of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, or South Korea, depending upon who you ask, what is the relevance of that in terms of ANZUS? Like, I've seen, like, in the past 10 years, my, maturing lifetime, that, China, of course, has made a big leap in debt bound, and it's not so much that the U.S. has declined, it's just that we've been stagnant for the past 15 years, and we haven't wanted, we haven't willing to look in the mirror and admit it. So, like, you know, in, like, when we're stagnant and everybody else is making leaps and strides to catch up to us, what eventually you have, in my opinion, and a lot of other people's back home opinion, is the situation where you have, like, a country that was staying with still in the, stuck in the mud for, like, the past 15 years, and countries like China, India, you know, and, you know, South Africa, South Korea were able to, you know, make strides to keep up with us. Like, what are your ideas of a multipolar world, you know, actually taking over the realm of this
kind
of...
Can you do multipolar? Can I just agree? I think what you just said, it's so important to note that people believe what you say, but I just don't see that it's true. So you said we've been stuck in the mud for 15 years.
So the U.S.
Yeah, the U.S. The 1990s were an extraordinary decade in the United States. Just extraordinary.
Yeah, but most of that wealth has gone away.
That's only 11 years ago. Point one. Point two, an extraordinary decade, not only domestically but internationally. Everything that the U.S. believed about the post-World War II period and why it fought the Cold War came true in the 1990s. It was an extraordinary decade. Second, you say the U.S. is so stagnant. You know, iPhones, we had Tom Friedman recently here in Sydney, and he's much better with words than I am, so I'll try to paraphrase. You know, when I wrote The World is Flat in 2005, Tom Friedman said, right, thinking about this world, clouds were in the sky, Skype was a typo, and Facebook didn't exist. The pace of change in the last 5 years even has been extraordinary. The problem is twofold. One, we had innovation in the financial sector go awry, and second, average Americans haven't been benefiting because American innovation hasn't been creating jobs at home. It's been creating a lot of profits, profits abroad and profits for management and shareholders. That's the problem, but don't think the U.S. has been stuck in the mud. You know, you do this with young people, and just ask them, you know, how many eye devices have you got? Well, tell me about the last important innovation in the world that the U.S. didn't drive. That's the kind of question that I would ask, and that goes all the way to today.
Professor Watt, and then you can have a quick comeback.
The first thing is I very much agree with Jeff, actually, on this. I don't think the story I'm really telling is a story that's got much to do with America at all. It's a story about China. The fact is, America had managed to grow at, you know, what's the long run average? You know, 3% per annum, 4% per annum over the last 20 years. China would still be steaming up behind it. Because if you grow at 10% per annum, mm-hmm. and there's 1.2 billion of you, it's size is everything. And for that reason also, I've never been, I mean, I can see what the idea of the BRICS was about. But I think to lump them together is to overlook something terribly important. The B and the R are very different from the B and the K.
Yep.
And the reason for that is billion people makes a difference. Yep. These two entities, it's hardly the right quality. We've never seen a billion person state with a modern industrial economy. And now we're seeing two emerge suddenly. And I think it's not a matter of looking at America and saying, what did America do wrong? It's just a remarkable and wonderful and terrifying fact that all of a sudden countries with a big population of a billion are working the trick that the English started working in the 1760s and the rest of Europe started working in the 1780s, and it jumped the Atlantic to America and it jumped to Australia, and the Japanese somehow made it work in their own way in the 1870s, but now the Chinese, and I agree with Jeff, I think a generation behind India is making this work too. Now, what kind of world does that lead to? It certainly leads to a multipolar world. I don't believe for a moment that we're going to end up with a world in which China is dominant. In fact, what I said before. But I do think that China, and I don't even think China's going to dominate Asia. I think Japan is too strong. I think India's too strong. I think America is too strong and not prepared to leave India, leave Asia to China. But I do think that in Asia, the US-China strategic competition for the next few decades at least will be the single most important determinant of the regional order. And I do think, I should make a point, I completely agree with everything Jeff said about the US-China relationships win-win-win picture. It's true, it's a fabulous story. But as he foreshadowed, my question is just, yes, sure, that's a huge incentive for the US and China to get this right.
Yeah.
But you can have huge incentives to get things right and still get them wrong. There's huge incentives to not smoke, but they still sell cigarettes. And if you look at the way in which, if you ask, you know, the correct response to those incentives is for the US and China to start working together to build an order in which their strategic competition is managed. And I'm less confident than Jeff is in the data we've seen the last few years that order is being built.
I hate to be a party pooper, but we've got to wind this up in about a quarter to. Malcolm, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to see if I've got Hugh right. And I don't think Hugh and Jeff disagree that much, frankly. And by the way, Australia's population is growing faster than America's.
It is?
Yeah, I just looked that up. But I'm sort of surrounded by researchers, so I might But Hugh, is your contention, your thesis is, just correct me if I'm wrong, this is how I understand it. You're saying that regardless of whether, you know, this would be justified, a policy of containment / confrontation towards China, which had been the previous policy, is undesirable because A, it will be futile, and B, its only consequence will be to make the inevitable state, that is to say, one of competition, more aggravated, acrimonious, and more likely to lead to war. Therefore, and I thought your point that peace is a value was a very good one. Therefore, you say, the aim should be recognizing that there will be a competition between these powers, and of course there is one now, to ensure that it is, as far as possible, harmonious, each side understanding the other's position, reasonably transparent, so that all of those arguments about interdependence that Jeff so elegantly described, with those percentages of imports turning into exports and so forth, that interdependence is is recognised, and we can, in a different world, enjoy a period of prosperity comparable to that we've enjoyed over the last three or four decades.
Yeah, no, look, that's exactly right. Right at the heart of it is the thought that, and it's a very important part of it, I don't regard escalating strategic competition resulting in a Cold War or a hot war for that matter as inevitable. I think we can build an order in Asia which accommodates China's growing power and retains a very strong role for the United States and finds a place for India and keeps a place for Japan. But I think at the heart of that is going to need to be a manner of dealing between the US and China, which is very different from what either has in mind at the moment. Because I think, and I shorthand this, is very crude, but I do it deliberately because it's provocative. And that is, the United States is going to have to treat China as an equal. China's going to have to treat the United States as an equal. Mm. Now, both of those are very difficult constructs. There are historical models. I use the historical model of the concept of Europe in the 19th century as an example of a system in which a number of states were still strategic competitors. They certainly were, but they framed their strategic competition within a shared understanding that neither of them was going to try and dominate the system. And that they'd recognise that if they tried, that all the others would gang up against them. And so it was a competition that could take place within a set of rules, and those rules were sufficiently robust, or understandings I should perhaps say, were sufficiently robust for the interdependent stuff to keep going. And that was, not a coincidence, that's the century in which Europe took over the world, was the European century. If this is going to be the Asian century, it's going to have to be built on a set of strategic understandings that don't, so to speak, prevent competition entirely, but put a frame around it which prevent it getting out of control. And my anxiety at the moment is that a US posture which is shaped around preserving primacy in Asia for the United States, and a Chinese policy which is shaped around asserting the primacy, is not compatible with building that kind of
concept. Could I jump in here very quickly? Let's talk Taiwan for a second. I know you're very interested in Taiwan, Michael. I think you said, Hugh, in your quarterly essay, just to show you that I read it all, you said that one thing Australia could do for the United States is to recommend to the US that over time the US says publicly that Taiwan is part of China. Interesting statement. My response to that, again, would be an interdependence one. We don't need to say that. Have you ever noticed how much of Shanghai Taiwan owns, or how many Taiwanese people there are lining up on those difficult business visas to get into Shanghai? You know, that I think that the strategic management, and again, we're in agreement here, that it's about can you manage these things strategically. But if you take a case like Taiwan, we know that the pace of economic integration, the win-win economic integration between Taiwan and the mainland is extraordinary. Therefore, it's in everyone's interests for those incentives to predominate. Therefore, it's in everyone's interests not to take big symbolic stances, or at least to keep reuttering symbolic stances that all sides understand. When did that potentially go out of control? It went out of control when the Taiwanese president thought that a serious independence push was a big idea. I think the Taiwanese people have decided that was a mistake. So even if you take a difficult flashpoint kind of issue like Taiwan, I believe that these economic incentives have been having a really beneficial impact, and I don't see why that should go down. And I do believe that the kind of interdependence that we see today is just fundamentally different from the early 20th century, when it really was all about trade. Today it's much more about multinational firms with complex ownership, complex supply chains and the like. I agree with you that it could go wrong, but even in that hard case of Taiwan, I don't see that.
Just to slightly refine what I actually say about Taiwan. My position on Taiwan is that Australia should encourage the United States to say that it would actively support the eventual peaceful, consensual unification. All three of those adjectives are very important. And that is not to say that it should advocate that should happen anytime soon. But if that is the choice of the Taiwanese people, that is not something the United States would resist. Now, that's worth saying.
Absolutely. It would be an extraordinary change in the symbolism for the US to do that. And I'm saying that I think at the moment all sides keep the symbolism exactly the same because they know that the underlying reality is changing irrespective of what the symbolic statements are.
Well, that's the key question. I think obviously the evolution of the economic relationship between Taiwan and China is a very important reflection of the broader interdependence that we're both agreeing is so important. The fact is that under very clearly definable circumstances, the United States and China would go to war over Taiwan tomorrow. And the fact is neither Beijing or Washington are in control of that. That determines what's happening in Taipei. I'm not an expert on Taiwanese politics, but I've yet to meet someone who I thought was, be prepared to put their hand on their heart and say that they don't believe that Taiwanese politics could go that way again. And you know, there's a kind of a prudential principle here. If you tell me that the risk that the radio on my car won't work is 5%, then I'm not too worried about it. If you tell me the risk that the wing will fall off the 747 halfway across the Pacific, then I'm really worried. Now, this is a wing falling off kind of issue. This would destroy the Asia we know. But the Taiwan case is important because it's absolutely clear from the policies of both countries that they would go to war with one another, notwithstanding the unimaginable costs, economic and for that matter strategic, of that conflict, and the very significant risk it will escalate to a nuclear exchange. On the basis of their present policies, and walking away from that, redefining their relationship in a way in which Taiwan ceases to be what it is at the moment and has been for a long time, a symbol of the difference between their views of their respective positions in Asia, seems to me to be really critical to building towards the kind of future for Asia.
Professor Garrett's argument is that, isn't it, that massive tourism of Chinese tourists to Taiwan, massive Taiwanese investments in China, the de facto situation is very good, and despite ideological constructs that are inevitable, that we should hope and continue to work to see the current situation maintains itself. I mean, one of the problems I have with your presentation, I'm sorry we'll have to end this fairly soon, is that it doesn't deal with one key factor, not in the 1840s. Countries that did have the concert of Europe or practiced the concert of Europe were of a very similar ideological makeup, whereas the problem that we all face is that in this growing competition between China and the United States, whether it works out well or whether it works out badly, we have two very different political systems, and we have to put that into the judgment and into the balance.
However,
last comment on the two.
However, this is why I'm an ultimate economic liberal and determinist. You know, I think that Chinese economic growth is the most important thing that could happen, because over time it will create inevitable political incentives for liberalization in China, and that the trade increases the stakes in war, so it's a win-win-win. It's not only good for the Chinese people, it promotes political reform in China and it reduces the probability of conflict. Why would we oppose that?
Absolutely. Okay. Professor?
Yeah, three last points, and the point you raised is very important. The first one is, let me just make a historical point. Actually, in the 19th century, the countries of Europe saw themselves as having profound ideological differences. Russia was a totalitarian state, in effect. A Tsarist state. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was the weirdest patchwork of whatever in the whole history. Fascinating place, but Britain was a liberal parliamentary democracy. France was whatever particular phrase the French were going through that week, and as for Germany, I mean, these were very different countries, and they saw themselves having very big ideological differences. But they had one thing in common, and that is they all recognised that whatever their differences, the costs to them of strategic competition way outweigh the benefits, It was basically the same argument that JFK articulated in his inaugural. You know, we all read the same there, all that sort of stuff. We do have real differences with China, but we have immense shared interests in working really hard to get on with them. That doesn't mean we should make all the compromises. China has to too. The second point is that, I agree with Jeff that I think it's very likely that as China continues to get rich, its politics will change. Its politics have already changed a lot, could go a lot further, and I think that would make it a much nicer place to live. Whether it will necessarily make it more likely to accept American primacy or not, I'm much less clear. So I think it won't reduce the imperative for us to build a new understanding of America's role in Asia, and of course to make sure that China...
So you're saying more democratic China could be even more nationalist?
Well, it could actually be more nationalist. There's certainly no reason to believe that it's going to be less nationalistic. In the end, why should we expect Chinese to accept that American leadership is the only durable, conceivable order from our point of view? And the third point is just goes back to this issue. We are not going to have the luxury of deciding whether or not we have a policy that's based on interests or values. The fact is, we have an immense interest in trying to ensure that Australia lives in a region which is broadly peaceful over the next few decades. And that's the point about the peace is a value too issue, it's not a point where we're going to either think about strategy on the one hand or think about human rights on the other. The fact is that we are going to have to integrate these, and we're not going to get it all our own way. That's one of the things that's changed. For 200 years, being rich and powerful more or less meant being white. And that's what's changed.
Okay, well, thank you both very much for your very substantial and comprehensive presentations. And thank you, audience, for participating with some organising it too. I think we've all enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hugh.
Yeah, thank you.
I really didn't do it.
That's
you
yourself.
I
really
didn't do it.
Well, I really meant it. I thought that it was a very significant speech.
The Please, Karen.